Chapter 28. Kenny couldn't have been happier to be getting home a day earlier than he expected, and he knew Yekaterina would be pleased too. His hope was to surprise her and be waiting at her home when she returned from work. Imagine his surprise when her parents greeted him with less than enthusiasm. They appeared grim, preoccupied. Kenny remained upbeat, exulting over the change in his schedule that allowed this. "Is something wrong?"
"Well, we don't know," Mrs. Risto said. "Yekaterina sounded rather upset, said Mr. Steele had called an emergency meeting of some little group of yours, and asked her to be there."
Kenny almost blurted the name of the Millennium Force, but he was surprised enough that Raimi would have invited Yekaterina. What in the world was up, and why hadn't he heard directly from Raimi? Raimi knew that Kat knew about the Force, because Kenny had told him himself.
"Do you know where they're meeting?" Kenny said.
The Ristos shook their heads.
"We don't appreciate this, you know," Yekaterina's father said. "This whole period is supposed to be a time of peace and tranquility. I don't know what this little group is all about, but it can't be positive if it has to have emergency meetings that its members, specifically you, know nothing about, and that an outsider, specifically Kat, is asked to attend, and which upset her so. She's enough on edge because you were gone. Now, what is all this?"
"I don't know, sir, but I'll find out. Kat's peace of mind is my top priority, too, so I'll get to the bottom of this as fast as I can."
On his way home, Kenny tried calling everyone, starting with Yekaterina. Her phone immediately went to her message system, as did Raimi's and Bahira's and Zaki's. Finally, as he was entering his own house, Kenny reached his mother.
"Oh, Kenny, where are you?"
he told her.
"What's going on, Mom?" "I wish I knew. It's like our office has been vandalized."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, those silly things like the phony personnel report on Kat and the ridiculous note about you could have come from anywhere within the interoffice mail system. But someone walked off with our employee list, and now we've gotten another crazy report."
So the list Kenny had seen in Paris hadn't been the result of a computer hacking. Someone had provided the actual printout. He didn't even want his mother to know that yet.
"What crazy report?" "Oh, it's so upsetting. I'm not even going to try to tell you about it except in person. Can Dad and I come see you tonight?"
"Well, sure, but right now I'm looking for Kat. She's supposed to be meeting with the Millennium Force, but I don't know where."
"You don't know where? Just call Raimi and..."
"Come on, Mom, you don't think I've thought of that. Now, what's this report?"
"Like I told you, it's not something I want to talk about over the phone."
"Just tell me what it's about."
She hesitated.
"Well, it's about you.
But that's all I'm going to say for now."
Kenny dropped his stuff in his room and noticed something strange. The chair before his computer was out, away from the desk. He tended to be fastidious about stuff like that. He always pushed the chair back in and left the mouse in the same position. It looked skewed, too. "Great. Now I'm imagining things." He tried calling everybody again. What were the odds they had all turned their phones off without it being on purpose? They didn't want to hear from him. Why? They couldn't have known he was going to be home earlier, or he would have been invited to the meeting. Wouldn't he? Frustrated at being so helpless, he struck out for the Valley Bistro. The Force didn't always have its meetings there, but it was worth a shot. At least it was a place Kat would know how to get to, and maybe they made it easy for her. Kenny arrived to find them in the back room with, of all people, Kasim Marid. In an instant, Kenny knew something was terribly wrong. Raimi was pale and appeared grim. Zaki looked shell-shocked, as did Bahira. Kasim appeared stunned to see Kenny, but of course Kenny was most curious about Yekaterina. Her face was red, her eyes puffy. As soon as she saw him, she gathered up a sheaf of papers that appeared to be the same as everyone else's and bolted from the restaurant. Kenny followed, but she was sprinting.
"Kat,"
he hollered.
"Wait just a minute."
She stopped and whirled, pointing at him.
"I don't want to talk to you, Kenneth Williams. I don't ever want to see you again."
He stepped closer.
"Cat, wait. I deserve to know."
"Don't you dare," she said, and she turned and kept going. Kenny staggered back into the bistro and into the back room.
"I want to know what's going on," he said, "and I want to know now."
Bahira was the only person who would look at him, and she looked like death.
"You've been found out is all," she said.
"Found out?" Raimi looked up. "We know where your true loyalties lie," he said. "You can end the charade." Kenny plopped into the seat Cat had vacated.
"I'm listening," he said. "What are the charges?"
Raimi said sadly, "You can have my copy. I don't need to see any more." He slid it across to Kenny and stood. The others rose also.
"Why don't you look this over, and if there's anything more to be said, well, you know where to find us."
"Well, but...
what?"
"We're leaving, Kenny. The ball is in your court."
"Can't we talk about this, whatever it is?"
Raimi shook his head as the others left.
"Not right now. We're not in the mood."
Kenny fingered the pages and looked at the first page as a waitress came and asked if he wanted anything. All he could do was shake his head as he read a memo dated 3 days prior. "To Ignace Jospin, Executive Director, The Other Light International, Paris, France. From Operative 88288, Kenneth Bruce Williams, Israel. Re. Progress."
"First, Ignace, it was great to reunite with you and your brother despite the sad occasion of your cousin's death. It had been too long, and communicating like this is never as good as in person, especially when we share such a bond. I very much look forward to seeing you and Lothaire in Paris, and thank you in advance for making available to me the lovely Nicolette again. The nights can otherwise be lonely in a strange city, even one as beautiful as your capital. You'll be pleased to know that my parents remain wholly in the dark. It's nice that they are so naive. I don't doubt their sincerity, but the blind devotion believing parents have in their offspring makes duping them so easy. My dull-witted mother remains convinced that I share her beliefs and points to the night she claims to have led me to Jesus. Well, Mom, you have to mean it if you pray that prayer. I trust you got the personnel printout. My mother is making noises about putting locks on the doors. My access to her office won't cross her mind this millennium. My Uncle Raimi suspects nothing. I'm sure he was brought in on the Risto personnel matter, plus the later defaming note about yours truly. Imagine if they even dreamed I planted both those myself. Rest assured your fears over the new girlfriend are unfounded. She's no Nicolette, but she's cute enough, and more naive than my mother. Her parents are homely, swarthy little people who worship the ground I walk on. Her father was apparently a spectacularly unremarkable tradesman, and her mother is basically a nondescript homebody. They will not be an issue. I may even go through with marrying this girl, which will only make my work for you at COT that much easier. She is in another department which merely broadens my reach. I'll provide a virtual core dump of other vital information when I arrive. Keep Nicolette warm until I get there. I'll see you soon. Loyal to the other light forever. KBW. Kenny was nauseated. Where did one begin to try to defend himself against such a detailed, devastating document? He scooped up the pages and stood, woozy and feeling utterly alone. His parents would visit that evening. That loomed as an oasis. Surely they wouldn't believe a word of this. But who wrote this and where did they get their information? The nuances, the detail made it so much worse. And yet it was so dead on that Kenny was surprised someone didn't see through it. What were the odds that almost every line would incriminate him? Naturally, Kenny had never faced a crisis like this, but in the past when he had what now appeared minor petty issues, he'd turned first to his mother, then maybe to Raimi or his dad. Who could he turn to now? For all they knew, he was what the document purported. A turncoat. Hardly anyone had been spared. "Lord, you're all I have left," Kenny prayed as he headed toward home. "Please tell me you're still here."
He nearly wept with relief when he felt the peace only Jesus could give, but still Kenny had no idea how to dig himself out of this. And what was that vehicle that had crossed at the corner ahead of him? It looked like the van that had delivered him back to Israel. When it stopped, turned around, and came toward him, he stopped and stared. The window was lowered, and Nicolette leaned out. Kenny wanted to run, to warn her to stay away from him. But he couldn't jeopardize his cover with Tall, regardless of whether they were behind trying to ruin him. She jumped out and approached. "We missed our turn," she said. "Ignaz wants to fly out of Tel Aviv." "Back the way you came," Kenny said, still reeling and desperate to cover. "That'll take you to the main route toward Tel Aviv and the airport."
"You're a peach," Nicolette said, leaning close to kiss him on the cheek.
"Yeah, yeah, see ya," Kenny said, only realizing as she pulled away from him that Lothair had been hanging out the window and had shot a picture of the kiss. Chapter 29 Cameron Williams sat steely-eyed and somber in Kenny's living room as Chloe wept. He didn't know what to think. His son was denying everything, which he would do, whether innocent or guilty. Admittedly, the document that Cassim Marid claimed he had retrieved off Ignace Jospin's desk in Paris had so many glaring incriminations in it that it could easily have been a setup. But who would do such a thing, and who would know enough details to pull it off? "There's not a doubt in my mind that Cassim is behind this for all kinds of reasons," Kenny said. "But how would I ever prove that?" "Call me a typical mother," Chloe said, looking pleadingly at Cameron. "But I believe him." "Of course you do, and I want to, too."
"You want to, Dad? My word is not good enough for you? You always taught me to live in such a way that if someone brought a charge against me, no one would believe it. What have I done? How have I lived that makes no one but my mother believe me?"
"Yes, Cam," Chloe said. "That's a good question." Cameron sighed. "Maybe I know something you don't, Chloe."
"Oh, great," Kenny said.
"There's more?" "I got an anguished call from Abdullah this afternoon. He saw you at Tall headquarters in Amman today, Kenny."
"What? What was he doing there?"
"So you were there?" Chloe said.
"Of course I was. Didn't everyone know where I was and what I was doing? I was undercover, infiltrating."
"And," Cameron said. "Oh no, Dad. What now?" "Cassim delivered our copy of the memo to Cott. Raimi and I had it evaluated by a computer techie. It was sent from your computer, Kenny." Kenny just sat shaking his head.
"There has to be an explanation," Chloe said.
"Kenny, I need to hear it."
"What can I say, Mom? It wasn't me. You know we've never locked our doors around here. Anybody could have done it."
Cameron was as conflicted as he'd been since the glorious appearing. How he wanted to believe Kenny. But the evidence against him just kept mounting.
"What recourse do I have, Dad? Is this a case I can take before the judges?"
"Only if someone charges you with a crime. Has anyone done that?"
"I wish Cassim would. He's the one who seems to gain the most from this."
"What is he gaining?"
"He makes me look bad. He costs me Cat."
"Where is Yekaterina, by the way?" Chloe said.
"Where do you think? Anywhere but here. She won't answer her phone, won't see me. I guess I can't blame her, but I thought we knew each other better than this."
"Well," Chloe said, "those things you said about her parents..."
"I didn't say them. I love her parents.
Listen, something else is going to surface, and I need your help." Kenny told them about Nicolette and the picture.
"I just know they'll deliver it to Kat. Since I can't get anywhere near her, could you warn her?"
"I don't know," Cameron said.
"Of course I will," Chloe said. "And she's going to want to know what to do about work. I'll assure her that she can come and not worry about running into you."
"And why is that? You're finding me guilty too? Firing me?"
"Call it a suspension," Cameron said. "Just till we can figure this out."
"What can I do, Dad? Take a lie detector test? You know what this means if it's true?
I'm an infidel, an unbeliever. That means I die at 100 and go to hell. Do you really believe that about me?
No, Cameron said. I don't. But I don't know what to do about your reputation now or countering all this evidence.
They sat in silence a long time. Finally, Kenny spoke.
It seems that with all the people you know, all the people you've worked with, we have access to spiritual power few others have. If everybody who's worked with you and believed in you and supported you in the past would cooperate in prayer, I don't believe Jesus would let this injustice stand. Do you?
Cameron and Chloe looked at each other. Then Cameron addressed his son.
They would all have to know everything, Kenny. They would have to see all the evidence.
Dad, I've got nothing to hide. What have I got to lose? I believe Jesus is here and on his throne, and that lies will be exposed. I'm open to anything.
But that night, Kenny couldn't sleep. He sat at his computer and composed a message to the Millennium Force and copied it to Yekaterina.
Dear friends, you can't know what I'm going through, but perhaps you can imagine. Think how it would be if you were in my place and wholly innocent. I am, you know. Let me get that on the record from the start. I confess I'm hurt, deeply wounded, that you assume me guilty. I suppose all I can do now is to endure a little more than 2 more years until I turn 100, and when I am still here the next day, you'll know that I am a believer, that I belong to Christ, and that while I am not perfect, as I am a natural, I could not be guilty of this. Kenny didn't feel much better even after transmitting his defense, so he wrote separately to Yekaterina. My dearest love, I can only imagine how phony and hollow that sounds coming from me now. You are convinced I am guilty, and I don't know how to prove otherwise. Perhaps there's some deep pocket of love for me in your heart that misses what we had together and longs to believe all things, as the Bible says. Kat, I fell in love with you almost from the beginning. I can't even remember, nor do I wish to, life before you. I thanked God for you every day and looked forward to that great day when we would marry and be able to spend the rest of our lives together. Do me a favor tonight, will you, and read the love chapter, the first book of Corinthians, chapter 13. And while you are raw and aching, I know this may sound empty to you, too, but I want you to know that one day in the future, when the truth comes out, I will not hold it against you that you didn't trust me. I'd like to think that I would not have believed such charges about you, no matter how convincing, but I don't know. Regardless, I will forgive you, so don't let anything keep you from coming back to me. Whatever happens, you will always be my lifetime love, and there will never be another. With my soul, Kenny. Kenny lay wide-eyed on his back, staring at the ceiling. He didn't know why he was so desperate to sleep with no obligations in the morning. Finally, he rose and grabbed his Bible, taking it back to bed and reading what he had recommended to Yekaterina. Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy, and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith, so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things.
Love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part. But when that which is perfect has come, then that which is in part will be done away. When I was a child, I spoke as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see in a mirror, dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know just as I also am known. And now abide faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Kenny found himself weeping and longing for heaven, where Jesus had promised to wipe away all tears from his eyes. Lord, I need you, he said. I need your help. Lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. And finally, Kenny was able to doze. Abdullah called the Other Light headquarters in Amman before heading out the next morning. Sarsour answered, TTI. TTI, indeed, Abdullah said. Are your guests gone? Is the coast clear for me to return? Oh, Mr. Ababne, yes. And you have no idea how much Mudawar wishes to see you. He is so appreciative of your acceding to his request yesterday and keeping him from an embarrassing situation. Of all the kind things you have done since you have been here, that was the kindest. Anyway, yes, please come in. Kenny arose, not refreshed, but with an interesting new outlook. It was as if the Lord had spoken to his heart even as he slept. It was the strangest feeling, something that those like him were unlikely to grasp without an ordeal such as the one he was enduring. He was getting a taste, albeit a very small and entirely less violent one, of what it must have been like for Jesus to be betrayed and abandoned by his friends. Of course, Jesus was mocked and spit upon and struck, had a crown of thorns thrust into his scalp, had his side riven by a sword, and was eventually put to death. And he was more than innocent. He was perfect, sinless. It went without saying that Kenny couldn't say the same about himself, but he knew he could face the day. His soul was pierced by the loss of the love of his life, and all he could do was pray that truth and time would walk hand in hand, and that eventually Yekaterina would return to him. Meanwhile, the Lord seemed to be impressing upon Kenny to redeem the time. Nothing would be served by defending himself and moping about in misery. Jesus certainly never did either of those. Though he wasn't hungry, Kenny forced himself to pick fresh fruits and vegetables and to eat them with bread and wine. Normally he would have enjoyed this bounty from the Lord, and while he was grateful for it, he was eating only out of a sense of duty. He needed fuel to function correctly, and he wanted to fill his hours, until his vindication, however long that would take, with some sort of work for the kingdom. This day that would mean planning and writing and preparing curriculum that would make him a better Bible teacher, a better leader for the young charges at Kot that he prayed would once again someday be entrusted to him. Only the Lord would be able to keep his mind on the task and off Yekaterina and his troubles. For the first time since he had begun his unusual assignment in Amman, Abdullah was greeted warmly not only by Sarsour, but also by Mudawar. The latter actually emerged from his office with a smile and a two-handed shake for Abdullah. "Come into my office a moment, sir," Mudawar said. "Sit down. I must tell you I don't understand you. I disagree with you. You should be my enemy, and in many ways you are. But you honored me by your absence yesterday. I have to say, I wouldn't likely have afforded you the same courtesy, and I didn't expect it from you.
Indeed, you had warned me that you would do nothing of the kind. In fact, when finally at the end of the day I walked my guests out to their car, I expected you to be sitting in front of our door, prepared to shame me. Now you must tell me. Why did you not, and where in the world were you?
Chapter 30. The unique ministry the Lord had assigned Rayford Steele and his team in Osaze had gone more swimmingly than any project Rayford could recall, but that very fact niggled at him every spare moment. Had he erred in believing that this period, this millennial kingdom with Jesus on the throne of the world, would be a time of unmitigated peace? Clearly, things were different than they had ever been. But while it seemed that in every city and town and outpost, citizens were eager to hear from the Lord, willing to work with those he had sent, and desperate to be sure their young people made decisions for Christ, that angelic visit from Annas had both inspired and rattled Rayford. For if the Lord himself was in charge, why did Rayford and his little band need a rear guard? From whom were they being protected? Everyone had been affected by the drought and famine that had resulted from Egypt's disobedience. And so everywhere Rayford and the others traveled, things seemed to turn around immediately. The preachers preached, the builders built, the consultants consulted, and everyone on the team got the chance to lead someone to salvation virtually every day. It soon became apparent to Rayford, however, that those with natural bodies, himself, Chaim, and Mac, had way less stamina than the glorifieds. Without consulting anyone else, Rayford began planning a long break after what he expected to be a huge meeting in Siwa the next evening. The naturals needed it, and perhaps some respite from the work would calm his troubled mind. Successful as it was, the work wasn't easy, partly because Rayford and the others remained committed to living in the motorhome. They could afford to stay elsewhere, but crowded as it was, it seemed the most prudent use of their resources. As they sat debriefing after a particularly stressful but also successful day of ministry, Chaim reported that the welcoming committee in Siwa expected one of the biggest crowds of their entire effort.
"Apparently there will be protesters there, too," he said. "But we've never worried about opposition before."
In the middle of their confab, the awful news about Kenny arrived by fax from Israel. Rayford distributed the document to the others, then phoned Chloe for further details. He told her of the planned break and promised to be back as soon as possible. When the others had read the document and Rayford had told them what Chloe had said, he added, "There is no question Irene and my daughter and I are biased, so I would ask that we simply accede to my grandson's request that we covenant together in prayer and seek the Lord over this." And so it was that Rayford and Irene and Chaim and Sion and Mac and the Barneses knelt and prayed. Sion began, and then Chaim, and soon all were praying at the same time. Several minutes later they prayed in succession again, but Rayford noticed a change. Whereas they had begun haltingly, seeking God's wisdom, asking him to shed light on the truth, now they seemed to be praying for Kenny for strength, for endurance. One by one, those with glorified minds and bodies, those who had been in heaven, expressed in their prayers that the charges against Kenny did not resonate with them. Finally, Mrs. Barnes closed the prayer meeting. "Lord," she said, "I barely know this boy, but I know you and you know him, and you've made it clear to my spirit that he belongs to you. I pray swift justice for him and for those who seek to destroy him. In the name of Jesus," and they all chorused their amens. For some reason, despite how long Rayford had lived in this new world, it still surprised him to emerge from the heavily curtained mobile home to a moon brighter than the sun had once been. But with a wide-brimmed hat and dark wraparound sunglasses, he could pretend. And an hour's amble at midnight often cleared his head. This night, however, after whispering his intentions to Irene, Rayford found the night wasn't much cooler than the day had been, He rolled up his sleeves as he moseyed along, trying to pray, trying to imagine the future, and, yes, despite the interest and challenge and novelty of the millennium, longing for heaven. Such complications as the clearly bogus charges against Kenny would not invade such a paradise. Rayford had learned much about the Lord and about the future, yet still he did not understand God. Why was it that some days he seemed closer than even his throne in Israel, answering Rayford before his prayers were voiced, and other days, like now, he seemed distant and silent? Perhaps heaven would provide those answers. The occasional car and light truck passed Rayford in the wee hours, one driver stopping to see if he needed a ride. While on his way back to the camper, Rayford was startled to not see it in the distance where he thought he had left it. Shrugging and assuming he had merely misjudged the distance and that it would appear on the horizon around the next bend, he lowered his head and continued trudging. Rayford looked up quickly at a sound and saw a plain black sedan racing toward him. It skidded into the dust on the other side of the road as the window rolled down, and an Egyptian with a leathery, lined face leaned out and hollered in a raspy, ancient voice, "Are you Rayford Steele, the man of God?" Rayford considered joking that he was at least half right, but the man seemed so urgent that he simply said, "I am." The man emerged quickly and crossed the road, leaving the door open. "I am Ishmael," he said, embracing Rayford tightly and then shaking his hand in a firm grip. "I have need of you." "But how did you find me and—"
"I asked around and stopped by your motor home. I was told I'd likely find you on the road. You must come with me. Believers are being persecuted and the undecided harassed."
"Where? And what can I do?"
"Come, come," Ishmael said, pulling Rayford across the road to the other side of the car and opening the door.
Rayford noticed dark green blankets covering lumpy mounds in the back seat. "Where are we going?"
"Not far, but we must hurry. And thank you in the name of the Lord. Sit in the front. I have foodstuffs filling the back."
Rayford settled in and was buckling his seatbelt as Ishmael rushed to slide behind the wheel. Before the driver had even shut his door, Rayford felt the cold steel of a weapon pressed against his neck. He turned far enough to see a young man and woman who had emerged from under the blankets.
"What is this?"
"Just cooperate and you will not be hurt," Ishmael said, his voice suddenly sounding younger as well.
The man covered his own face with his hand and pulled away what appeared to be a buildup of rubber cement and hair. His face was youthful and smooth. As the car spun in the dust and then lurched onto the road, the man behind Rayford said,
"Put your hands behind your neck and interlace your fingers."
Rayford hesitated.
"Do it now,"
the young woman said, producing handcuffs. Still, Rayford waited. "You could shoot me through the brain, or I could leap from this car, and still God would spare me," he said. "Surely you know that."
"Risk it, then," Ishmael said.
Rayford considered it. What a message that would send. He could envision himself tumbling and rolling in the dirt, then jogging unharmed back to the others. But the Lord suddenly spoke quietly in his heart. "Comply. I am in this." How could it be? God was in this? Rayford locked his fingers behind his head, and the young woman cuffed him. He knocked off his own hat, returning his manacled wrists to his lap, and used his elbows to balance as the car careened through the countryside, dust billowing behind them.
"So you fooled my compatriots like you fooled me," Rayford said. "They believe I'm assisting you in some spiritual emergency?"
"Hardly," the young woman spat. Ishmael shushed her with a raised hand.
"Do not speak to the hostage," he said.
"I'm a hostage now? And who do you think will pay a ransom for me?"
"We have no need of a ransom," Ishmael said. "We require only you."
Rayford became aware of the tightness of the cuff on his left hand and tried to maneuver his wrist to relieve the pressure. Immediately, the young woman leaned over the seat and checked it herself, unlocking and loosening it before securing it again.
"Rahima," Ishmael shouted at the black-haired girl. "What are you doing?"
"It does not need to be so tight,"
she said, a whine in her voice.
"He is not here to be coddled."
"What am I here for?" Rayford said. Ishmael kept his eyes on the road, now moving at more than 100 miles an hour.
"You are here, so you will not be there."
"There?" "And where is that?"
"Siwa."
"You intend to hold me the entire weekend?"
"Perhaps longer."
"And may I ask for what purpose?"
"To prove our God is greater than yours."
Rayford couldn't stifle a laugh.
"Good luck."
"So far, it's working." "How will keeping me from Siwa accomplish anything?"
"You made the mistake of advertising."
"All of our visits are advertised. We want the people to know we're coming so they can prepare their hearts and minds, not to mention mustering teams of volunteers to help us improve their cities."
"You've done nothing more than frighten the people into believing God will strike them dead if they don't comply with his wishes."
Rayford shook his head. "It seems God himself may have persuaded them of that.
So you are with the other light?"
"We don't call ourselves that."
"You don't? You're not tall?"
"I was unaware there were other rebel factions."
"Oh, we are tall, but our O does not stand for other. It stands for only. Consider us the enforcers, the hardliners. We aver that we are not fighting your God. We treat him as if he doesn't exist."
"So you're pretty much idiots." Rayford saw Rahima cover her mouth.
"You're not in a position to insult us, Mr. Steele."
"Come now. You were born in this millennium, but surely you know the history, have seen the power of God. No, Jesus is on the throne.
So the rulers would have us believe."
"But you don't."
"We don't, and we will prove it, as we also are advertising. We have publicized that our God will keep you from appearing in Siwa, proving once and for all that you claim to represent a God who is capricious, unjust, and non-existent."
"He doesn't exist, and yet he is capricious and unjust?
Detaining me will prove nothing.
God will do what he chooses."
"But the hearts of the people will no longer be swayed. Or if they are swayed, they will be swayed our way."
"Toward Lucifer?"
"Yes, toward our God, who shall overcome."
"Overcome what or whom? A God, you say, does not even exist?"
"He will lead us to overcome all who oppose him." "Even now, centuries before he is released, massive preparations are underway."
"Released by whom?"
"We believe he will release himself."
"From confinement by whom?"
"He incarcerated himself to prove a point."
Rayford laughed aloud. "If he did that, he's proved my point."
"Your point?"
"That you're idiots. Now who's capricious? You really believe your all-powerful leader locked himself away for 1,000 years and will eventually emerge to prove he's in charge?"
Ishmael shook his head. "When you see what's happening in his name, you will not be so cavalier."
Ishmael finally slowed about 1/2 mile from a lonely intersection, then turned right onto a road lined on either side by black uniformed armed soldiers. They stood at attention and saluted as the sedan passed. Ishmael waved and waved. The route led to an underground entrance, wide enough for the car, and Rayford was intrigued by the quick plunge into utter darkness and a coolness he hadn't experienced for years. The decline must have continued more than 300 yards, but Rayford soon quit trying to calculate how far below the surface they must be. They rolled to a stop before a small structure that reminded him of a modular home, and Ishmael signaled for several personnel to take Rayford from the car.
"When did you last eat?"
Ishmael said. About 6 hours ago.
Good. Let him wait another 18 for just enough food to keep him functioning. And take his shirt, shoes, and socks.
Chilly, Mr. Steele?
Of course.
Your slacks and undershirt should be enough. A little chill will keep you alert.
Rayford was led to a cavernous opening that proved incongruous, as it sported walls bearing huge flat-screen TV monitors and high-tech desks and workstations, but was ringed by dirt-floored cells enclosed by prison bars. Each cell bore a prisoner, a man, a woman, or a young person, all sitting on steel mesh beds. Each wore an expression of fear and resignation, and each had one armed guard posted outside his or her cell. Rayford found himself grateful beyond measure that his guard was Rahima.
"You know what your name means, do you not?" he said as she gently guided him inside, removed his handcuffs, and pulled the cell door shut.
"Do tell," she whispered, her face a mask of boredom, but her eyes dancing.
"Compassionate. And you have already proven to be that."
She shrugged and sat with her back to the bars, her weapon tucked between her knees. Rayford sat on his metal frame, already beginning to shiver, and talked loudly enough so only she could hear. He asked her to tell him about herself, but she demurred.
"Come now," he said. "I can tell you're smarter than this, more curious than this. It's written all over you that you know better."
"My back is to you," Rahima said, turning her head to make herself heard. "How can you tell what's written all over me?"
"What did you mean when you said hardly when I asked if Ishmael had also fooled my team?"
"So much for how much you know," she said. "We never even found your team."
"Then how..."
"We've been following you. Not a week passes that you don't venture out into the night. We merely waited for you. We sent one team to neutralize your people, and we picked you up."
"My people have also been seized?"
"No, I told you. We couldn't find them."
"You saw me leave the motorhome and then lost track of it? It's a big, slow, ponderous thing."
"Believe me, I know. Ishmael is irritated to the point of exasperation. You must not tell him I said anything."
"Yeah, I'm gonna tell on you, get you into trouble," she giggled.
"What happens in here, Rahima?"
"Monitoring, tracking."
She pointed to the screens where Rayford could make out huge manufacturing operations in progress.
"Munitions plants all over the world, in virtually every country."
"All planning for the big war at the end of the millennium?"
She nodded.
"It will make the so-called Armageddon look like child's play."
"Jesus himself took care of that."
"So you would have us believe."
"And this build-up of armaments is for what?"
"For Lucifer, who will lead the charge."
"Against the non-existent God?"
Rahima hunched her shoulders as she seemed to throttle a laugh again.
"I know how it sounds," she said, "but the battle is against the believers in the God who is not there.
But we believe so deeply that we have obeyed his edict against weapons of war. You and yours would attack an unarmed people?"
"Better safe than, you know."
"And you will not even be there. How old are you?"
90.
"A mere child. Does it mean nothing to you that all your older compatriots are dead? Does that not tell you anything?"
She fell silent.
"It does tell you something, doesn't it? How do your fearless leaders explain that one? The God you claim doesn't exist, and yet whom you oppose somehow curses those who reject him for 100 years, and no one gets the picture?"
She shook her head slowly.
"No wonder you call us idiots."
"Don't be an idiot, Rahima. Think."
Again she was quiet for several minutes, Rayford knew he shouldn't be hungry until morning, but just knowing he wouldn't be given any food until dinner time the next night gave him pangs, and he was shuddering. He rubbed his arms and brought his knees up to his chest, wrapping them in his forearms. "We're not all atheists, you know," Rahima said. "Of course I know. How could you be?" "I couldn't." "You're right. I've seen friends and relatives die right on schedule. Only a fool denies that." "So you believe in God?" "I believe he exists. I just don't like him much." "Let's talk about it." "I'd better not." "Then I'll talk, and you listen. Is it going to bother you when I eat? They deliver my meal to me right in front of you. It's part of the deal." "Of course it'll bother me, but I'll survive." But Rayford had underestimated the power of her simple sandwich. He smelled it as if it lay under his nose, and he imagined every bite. He looked away, tried to think of something else, and concentrated on his recitation of history, especially his own. He talked of his life, his family, the rapture, being left behind. And while Rahima appeared interested and even at times enthralled, she furtively passed the last few bites of her sandwich through the bars to him. Rayford eagerly wolfed it down, worrying aloud about the cameras that might reveal her deed and get her into trouble. "What's the worst they can do to me?" she said. "They need me. We're still in the minority, and history proves I'll be around only 10 more years anyway." Rayford smiled. "Whose side are you on? You're proving my points." When Rayford began telling her of his own salvation and all his experiences during the tribulation, Rahima finally turned to face him. He surprised himself by how much scripture he had committed to memory over the years, and as he held forth, he quoted passage after passage of prophecy that had come true, just as the foretellers had predicted. Finally, Rahima said, "How could anyone doubt God after all that?" "They couldn't," Rayford said. "To oppose him, they had to acknowledge that he existed, but that they simply wanted to go their own way, like you." With that, Rahima stood and turned her back, pacing before his cell. Chapter 31. Irene was awakened just before dawn by a gentle rap on her door. "Forgive me," Chaim said. "I was looking for Rayford." Irene sat up and pulled back the blind, making her cover her eyes. "He went out for a walk around midnight," she said. "I don't recall his returning." "I'm sure he's about," the old man said, smiling. "It's not as if we moved." Rayford wouldn't have been surprised to find it was noon, as long as he had been talking, as uncomfortable as he felt, and as tired as the young Rahima looked. She was fairer complexioned than most in the compound, despite her dark brown eyes and hair so black it could have been dyed, but clearly wasn't. Rayford's watch, however, read 0700 hours. By now his people would miss him, wonder about him, worry about him, pray for him. Where had they gone that he had been unable to see the vehicle and that Ishmael's troops had also missed them? It wasn't like them to venture out after settling in for the night. Rahima appeared weary. Rayford was too, of course, but worry and earnestness fueled him. "When does your shift end?" he said. "Oh," she said, "we're 24 hours on, 24 hours off, and I only just began before we apprehended you." "You're not serious. You're stuck with me until midnight?" She nodded. "Poor girl, you're going to know more about me than I know about myself, because I plan to talk until I cannot go on." She chuckled. "That will keep me awake, keep me out of trouble. But I am supposed to be talking to you, propagandizing you, selling you on the inevitability of our cause and the certainty of our victory in the end, as evidenced by all the work you see being accomplished on the screens. This will continue for centuries until we are invincible."
Oh, dear one, Rayford said. You have already lost. Victory is ours. You have so little time, really. Follow your heart and mind. Change your course. Join the forces of the one true and living God before it is too late. Rahima turned and faced Rayford. You are a nice and well-intentioned man. But it's you who are out of time. She looked at her watch. In fewer than 17 hours, your God will have been shown incapable of delivering you from our hands in time for your meeting. Then we will know whose God is worthy. I already know, and so do you. And now I will tell you about my daughter and my son. Oh, I'd love to hear about your children. I have a son, too. Surely not. You're much too young. I wouldn't have guessed you were even married. I didn't say I was. How old is he? 4. And you wish him to live to be only 100? Rahima set her jaw and looked away. Tell me of your children, she said. Abdullah sat across from Mudawar in his office, leaning toward him earnestly. So you feel, as you have expressed it, that you owe me one. Yes, you earned it. You deserved it. One for your side. What will it be? I have no idea what you have in mind. You know my heart's desire, that you and Sarsour come to faith. Come now, Abdullah. That would not be a favor. That would be surrender, defeat, and we both know it's not going to happen. Now take advantage of my largesse. I was thinking more in terms of your borrowing our list of recruits. Big sale, today only, limited time only, while they last. You get one shot at communicating with the very people you're so worried about. That's fair, isn't it? I don't fear that, and, like I say, you've earned it. Of course, I would have to see what you're saying to them before I allow it to go out. I would be a fool to pass up that opportunity. So I accept and thank you. But there is one more thing. Try me. I confess I did not absent myself yesterday for your benefit. Really? Well, it worked to my benefit nonetheless, so our deal is still valid. The truth is, I thought I recognized someone in the entourage and didn't want him to see me. Mudawar sat back and seemed to study Abdullah. The one from Israel? That's the one. Mudawar nodded. You know him? I believe I do. From? We go way back. I am a friend of his family. And you're telling me they are unaware that he works for us? Abdullah couldn't speak, couldn't move. It's true, then. Well, Mudawar said, this is a complicator. If you know him, you know where he works, and it should be no stretch for you to understand now that he is a mole, a double agent, if we were using spy vernacular. He has his people believing he's infiltrating us, while in reality, it's the other way around. You know I will have to expose him, Abdullah said. I cannot allow such damage to the kingdom and to the people I love. Oh, Master Ababnane, are you really so naive? Do you believe that after all the time you've spent in our offices, coming and going and doing us favors, that you retain an ounce of credibility among your own? Do you not suspect that with our closed-circuit cameras and our hidden still cameras that we can build an airtight case for you, yourself having flipped? Don't be ridiculous. I am well past 100 years old. A natural my age has a built-in pedigree with the Lord. The fact that I remain alive testifies that I am his and he is mine. And thus you are incapable of sin? Oh, it will surprise believers, horrify them even, but how will you explain it? You don't wear the robe of the righteous. You don't speak Hebrew, at least not when you are with us. These cameras have sound, you know. but everything I have said in here would implicate you, not me.
Everything? You don't think we could find something, anything, in all the time you've been here that might portray you as our friend rather than our enemy? Anyway, you can tell the world that we let you set up shop here, knowing full well who you were and what you were about. Who in his right mind would believe it? You hardly believed it yourself.
Silently, Abdullah was praying desperately. Had this idea been his own and not the Lord's? Had his foolishness damaged the work of the kingdom?
Now why don't you work on the message you'd like to send to our list, and I'll take a look at it when you're finished.
Abdullah stood quickly, afraid that if he said anything more he would multiply the damage. When he opened the door, Sarsour, who had plainly been standing close enough to hear, quickly moved away. Abdullah walked to his desk, his knees weak, sat and buried his head in his hands. He couldn't believe this was happening and that he had helped perpetuate it. Would the Lord want him to actually take Mudawar up on his offer? The idea of communicating to the very audience Tall targeted was too good to pass up, but would Mudawar find a way to use it against him? Of course he would. Abdullah's mind was too jumbled to even think about crafting a message. Soon it would be time to make his daily run for Mudawar's coffee and Sarsour's snack. Should he continue to do that, to serve his enemies out of love while they stabbed him in the back? Chloe was miserable, trying to function while her mind was entirely on Kenny. She knew Cameron believed him deep down, too, but Cam's detached manner frustrated her. She wouldn't be happy until Kenny was vindicated. During the morning break, Yekaterina dropped in. As soon as the women saw each other, they both dissolved into tears. "Pardon my saying so, Mrs. Williams," Yekaterina said, "but you look as bad as I feel." "This is like a death in the family," Chloe said, "and we'd better have no more of those." "I'm sure glad you told me about that picture before it showed up in my email last night." "Who sent it?" "Who knows? Anyway, I came by to tell you that I've asked Maddie for the afternoon off. I can't work, can't concentrate. I'm doing more harm than good here."
"You'll be even more miserable at home, Kat. What will you do?"
"If I tell you, will you promise not to tell anyone else?" Chloe nodded.
"Anyone?"
"Whatever you say, Kat."
"I have to see Kenny."
"Well, good. I think that's good. Does that mean that you've decided?"
"It doesn't mean anything. I still don't know what to think, but I owe him a face-to-face."
As Abdullah slowly made his way toward the street coffee vendor, nothing was making sense to him. He had somehow painted himself into this corner, and the Lord seemed silent. Did that mean he was disappointed in Abdullah? He hadn't felt that way for years. He jumped when Sarsour touched his shoulder and whispered,
"Can we talk around the corner?"
"Certainly, son. What is it?"
They found a small table under a shade tree. Sarsour looked deeply troubled, his face clouded over. He kept peeking around as if to be sure no one was watching.
"Mudawar told me to follow you, keep an eye on you. I suppose he was afraid you were leaving to inform on us, and that you would be gone for good."
"It may come to that, Sarsour. I suppose you heard our conversation." The young man looked down and nodded.
"I knew you were coming back. You didn't take your Bible. Plus, you have never let anything get in the way of your being kind to us, not even this. Returning with Mudawar's coffee will be like heaping coals of fire on his head, will it not?"
Abdullah couldn't hide his surprise.
"You're quoting scripture to me now?"
"I told you how I was raised. Until I left home, my parents took me to worship all the time."
"You hated it?"
"Most of it. But that doesn't mean I didn't learn a few things."
It was clear to Abdullah that Sarsour had something on his mind.
He kept furtively glancing about, taking a breath as if to speak, then seemingly thinking better of it.
"What is it, son? You can talk to me." Sarsour
suddenly sat forward and rested his elbows on the table, burying his face in his hands.
"I visited my parents last night."
"Yes," he nodded miserably.
"Just as I was about to knock, I noticed through the curtain that they were praying."
"Really?"
"They knelt beside each other at the couch. I can't tell you the effect it had on me. It wasn't as if I hadn't seen this frequently all my life. They both loved the scriptures, and I often saw them reading. But standing there at the front door and seeing them like that, I was overcome with the knowledge that they were praying for me."
"How did you know?"
"I don't know. I just did. I felt low, ashamed, Mr. Ababne. I felt worthless and guilty."
"About what?"
Sarsour lowered his hands and snorted. "You know my profession, and you ask that?"
Abdullah put a hand on Sarsour's shoulder and smiled. "Well, we both know that I know you're worthless and guilty. I'm just wondering what brought this truth to you."
The young man took a deep breath and let it out. "It had been a long time since I felt God had spoken to me."
"And now you did. What was he saying, Sarsour?"
"Nothing specific. I just felt his presence."
"Of course you did. Your parents must have been praising him. You know what the Bible says about that. He inhabits the praise of his people. He was there."
Sarsour nodded.
"I know. That just made me feel worse, so I turned to go. One of my parents either saw me or heard me, because suddenly the door opened and my mother called out to me. She said, 'Sarsour, have you ever felt like an answer to prayer?' Well, I sure hadn't, and I didn't then. But of course I went inside. What else could I do? Even my father wept when he saw me. I asked them what was going on. My mother said they had both been troubled in their spirits about me all day. I laughed and said that was nothing new, but she said no, it was something deeper and more specific, as if I was going through some new crisis. How could they have known?"
"What was your crisis, Sarsour?"
"Just everything that happened yesterday. The visit, your disappearing, our pretending not to know that the man from Israel was an infiltrator."
"What?"
"Oh, surely you know, Mr. Ababne. You're a friend of the family. We do have a plant at that Children of the Tribulation Ministry in Israel, but it's certainly not Kenny Williams."
"Who is it?"
"Kasim Marid."
Abdullah fought to keep his composure. He wanted to leap and shout, and he couldn't wait to clear Kenny's name.
"You know I cannot sit on this information, Sarsour. This will cost you your job. Why are you telling me this?"
"Because I have had enough, and God is speaking to me. You know, for a long time I really thought the other light was a valid alternative. At first, they seemed like honest, honorable people. But to mislead you as Mudawar has, and to tell you outright lies as he did this morning, well, that combined with what happened to me last night, this is not working for me."
"What happened to you last night?"
"Just seeing my parents praying, knowing they were praying for me, and then having them confirm that. I didn't say much to them, but I couldn't wait to get back to my place and see if God was still trying to talk to me.
And?"
"He was. Of course. He always has. I had just shut him out for so long."
"What was he telling you?"
"You know, sir. He wants me. And when I overheard your conversation with Mudawar this morning, it was the last straw. I couldn't believe it when he told me to follow you this morning. I was going to anyway, but that would have tipped him off that something was up."
"We'd better get back before he comes looking for you," Abdullah said.
"I don't care if he does. I'm not setting foot in that place again without being a believer.
I was hoping you'd pray with me.